Happy Hump Day, Oregon! I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Wednesday, so this is an archive show, but it last aired 2 to 4 years ago, so unless you're a hardcore long-time listener, it's probably new to you. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on May 26th of 2013. Under the headline, Joseph Bank Robber Became VP of the Bank He Once Robbed. Here we go. When the First National Bank of Joseph, Oregon picked David Tucker as vice president in 1928, it didn't look like a particularly unusual thing to do. Tucker was a widely respected part of the community in Joseph. A successful stockman, he had over the previous 20 years forged a reputation for himself as trustworthy and honest, and kind and generous to boot. He was especially effective at taking hot-headed young lads under his wing and helping them out of bad situations and inspiring them to turn their lives around. When doing this, he almost certainly showed them his right hand. The thumb and forefinger were missing from it, blown off by a rifle bullet on October 1, 1896, during a bank robbery. During the bank robbery. The robbery of the First Bank of Joseph, Oregon. And Vice President Tucker had been one of the robbers. The robbery got its start when Tucker, then a 25-year-old cowboy, met a couple of professional stick-up artists who had come to the Joseph area and taken jobs shearing sheep. Their idea was to lay low for a while because a job somewhere else in the state had made things just a bit too hot for them. Their names were Cyrus Fitzhugh and James Brown. Brown and Fitzhugh soon found a saloon that suited their temperament, and its proprietor and bartender, John Martin, soon learned what the two of them really did for a living. Now, Martin, as it turned out, had a little personal grudge against one of the local bank's major stockholders stemming from a lawsuit that he'd lost. As for Tucker, he wanted money so he could afford to marry his sweetheart. So the four of them started making plans. The plotters made their move on October 1st, 1896. Bartender Martin hung around the bank and signaled the other three when he saw the bank teller come and open the place up. And then the three robbers rode up the street and tied their horses nearby and walked into the bank, guns out. There was already a problem, though. With an eye towards disguising themselves, the three of them had rubbed their faces with dirt and had done such a fine job of this that a group of schoolgirls thought that they might be African Americans. No black person had ever been seen in Joseph, so this was very exciting, and the girls had started following them. One of the three robbers, almost certainly Tucker, had turned to shoo them away. "Go back," he told them gruffly. "The bank is about to be robbed, and you might get hurt." For three desperados about to knock over an uninsured bank in a tiny cowboy town full of heavily armed, frontier-hardened law-and-order types, this was an extraordinarily stupid thing for them to say. But luckily for the bad guys, when the girls had gotten back to the school, nobody had believed them, and the coast was still clear. The three robbers stepped inside. Tucker stood by the door of the bank, pistol in hand, watching the street. Brown and Fitzhugh quietly got the cooperation of the five customers who were inside and waited for the teller, J.D. McCulley, to come out of the vault, which he soon did, looking down at the paperwork in his hands. "Stick 'em up," remarked Fitzhugh, pointing his sawed-off 12-gauge at McCulley. McCulley, without looking up, laughed at what he thought was a pretty funny joke and kept walking towards his window. When he arrived, he finally did look up. He was, to put it mildly, startled by what he saw. Quote, "Father has since frequently remarked that never before did he realize that a shotgun barrel was so big," remarked McCulley's son, Russell, many years later. The robbers were disappointed. The $8,000 or so that they'd expected to find turned out not to be there, and they were only able to put together about $2,000. They took a little extra time scrounging up every nickel in the place, and while they were doing that, Tucker, by the door, was starting to get very nervous. The word was out. Some observant neighbors had seen Tucker, bandana around his nose, standing in the door of the bank with a drawn pistol in his hand. It wasn't hard to figure out what that meant. Quote, "Those men are going to rob the bank!" yelled a passerby. This attracted Tucker's attention, and he pointed his pistol at him and ordered him to come stand with him on the steps of the bank. Several other people then came out of the building, and Tucker made them come join him as well. But the damage had been done. In W.H. Burton's Home Comfort Steel Kitchen Range store across the street, a young fellow named Alex Donnelly was looking over some used stoves when the two of them heard the cry. They looked up, Tucker pointed the pistol at them and invited them to join his growing throng of hostages, and instead, they ducked down behind the steel stoves and hustled out the back. Donnelly ran down the street to the general store and gave the alarm. The proprietor of the hardware store ran behind the counter and started handing out firearms. In an instant, the gun counter was emptied out and armed Joseph residents started closing in on the bank. Burton raced to the home of a local named Fred Wagner and asked to use his rifle. Wagner declined. Quote,
"I know my Winchester better than you," he said. "I will use it."
And he grabbed it and stepped into the street. Meanwhile, Tucker was watching all this and starting to panic. Quote,
"Hurry up," he shouted. "They're coming with guns."
Grabbing the sack of loot, Brown hustled out of the bank, followed by Fitzhugh with the group of hostages in front of them, serving as a human shield. Then, from behind the human shield, Wagner opened up on them with his .45-70 Winchester. The first shot missed. Tucker whipped round with his revolver and fired at the same instant Wagner's second shot roared out. Tucker's bullet missed Wagner's head by an inch or so. Wagner's bullet plowed into Tucker's gun hand, sending his pistol flying in a spray of blood and parts that included his trigger finger and his thumb. Wagner jacked the lever on his rifle and fired again. This bullet plowed into Brown's chest, throwing him down into a sitting position on the bank steps. Seconds later, he was dead. Fitzhugh raced back, braving Wagner's fire, grabbed the bag of loot that Brown had dropped, and sprinted for his horse. Bloodied, disarmed, and terrified, Tucker, the future vice president of the bank he'd just helped rob, ran from the scene on foot, leaving his horse behind, an angry and well-armed mob in pursuit. He soon took a charge of birdshot in the side from one of the hardware store's shotguns, and then a burly blacksmith got the jump on him, and he was taken roughly into custody. Meanwhile, Wagner had emptied out the rest of his rifle, shooting horses that were tied up nearby, apparently on the theory that one of them was Fitzhugh's. It wasn't, and as a result, when Fitzhugh was clambering onto his horse and Wagner had a clear shot at him, his rifle was empty. He hustled back to his house for more bullets, but by the time he returned, it was all over. Neither Fitzhugh nor the $2,000 was ever seen again. The entire town was shocked by Dave Tucker's involvement in this robbery. Everybody knew him, and almost everybody thought he was a nice young man, a talented stockman with plenty of promise, madly in love with a local girl who was kind of like the Doris Day of Joseph, Minnie Probstel. A few months later, McCauley, the bank teller, went to see him in the jail, and Tucker told his entire story. He'd gotten involved because he wanted enough money to buy a farm and marry Minnie. Minnie also went to see him in the jail. She told him if he'd stand up and take what was coming to him like a man, when he got out of jail, she'd be waiting for him. Well, Tucker drew a 6-year prison sentence for his part in the deed. 4.5 years later, he was out and moved back to Joseph and set about slowly winning back the trust and goodwill of the community. He worked hard, he saved his money, he bought a small flock of lambs, parlayed it into a big flock of sheep, bought a farm. When he felt he'd rehabilitated himself enough to deserve her, he proposed to Minnie, and she took him up on it. Eventually, in 1928, he made an investment in the First National Bank of Joseph, the institution that had succeeded the First Bank of Joseph, the bank he'd robbed 32 years before. And at that point, the bank shareholders cheerfully certified this former bank robber as fully rehabilitated by electing him vice president of the bank that he'd robbed. As for Fitzhugh, his name was all but forgotten for decades. But then, around 1940 or so, word came to Joseph from somewhere in Texas that he was being released from prison there, and was he still wanted in Wallowa County? The citizens of Joseph thought about this. Fitzhugh would be in his 70s. The local residents who'd participated in the robbery with him, saloon keeper Martin and stockman and bank executive Tucker, were friends and neighbors and respected citizens now. And the expense of a trial would be more than the total of the loot that had been lost from the bank. Quote,
"Therefore, Fitzhugh was given an opportunity to spend the balance of his life as a free man,"
McCauley's son wrote.
"That responsibility was up to him. Perhaps we will never know his decision."
Sources in this story have included works by Russell McCauley, James Yuksevich, Ben Brown, The Portland Morning Oregonian, and OregonPioneers.com.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I sure hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Also, if you're into fun Oregon history stuff, you should check out the weekly Influential Oregonian podcast. It's a panel podcast emceed by Marcus Axford from the Welcome to Oregon podcast with archaeologist David Winkler and yours truly, and sometimes a special guest. Runtime is 1 hour, and we get to interview interesting people from the Oregon pop history community and or discuss cool nuggets of Beaver State history. Check it out when you can. Wherever you get your podcasts, you will find it there, or you can cut straight to it with offbeatoregon.com/influential-o, all lowercase. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Fresh episodes of Offbeat Oregon History come your way at around 6 a.m. every weekday morning, so if you're looking for the next one, you haven't got long to wait. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.